You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Religion was a dirty word in China from as early as the late 19th century. In an effort to modernize the country, its leaders discouraged traditional religious practices, brought churches, temples, and mosques under tight government control, and, after the Maoist Revolution, banned religion altogether. But according to Ian Johnson, China is in the midst of a spiritual revival. 300 million people now belong to China's five major state-sanctioned religions, and their numbers increase dramatically each year. He examines this religious resurgence and the uneasy balance that China now maintains between church and state in his book, The Souls of China. It's published by Pantheon. Ian Johnson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and an author based in Beijing. I'm very pleased his book has brought him to our show. Hello.
Hi. Nice to be here.
You found that many Chinese people still aren't comfortable with the word religion.
Yeah, the word religion is kind of a taboo word in China. It's a neologism that was created about 100 years ago. And because in traditional China, there wasn't really this idea of separating religion out from the rest of society. This idea that we have in the West, that religion is something you do on a certain day of the week.
Because Confucianism and Taoism are just a basic part of the culture?
Yeah, they're all part of the culture. And I think it's the same in a way in many traditional societies around the world. Or even if you think of, say, Europe a few hundred years ago, if you were living in, say, a village in Italy or some European country, you know, religion was part of your lifestyle. It was just what you did. It wasn't something, you didn't identify yourself as a member of a particular faith, perhaps.
So were they more comfortable if you didn't use the word religion and asked them about faith or spirituality?
Yeah, that word faith is a lot better. Religion, it has this idea of something political, something that maybe the government is trying to control, or some sort of sensitive issue. Faith is something that the government supports, and it's a much more neutral term.
Is there also a stigma because the word religion brings back memories of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s and 70s after religious leaders were tortured and killed?
That's part of it also. Religion was stigmatized not just by the communists but by their predecessors, the nationalists, and by reformers going back over a century. So that word has become really loaded.
And even among ministers. You spoke to a man named Wang Yi, a minister who had founded a Protestant church in Chengdu, and he told you that his church's activities are cultural, not religious. How can a Protestant deny being a religious minister?
Well, I think he was thinking of the overall scope of things that they offer. They don't just have church services, but they have a kindergarten, they have a library, they have seminaries. They provide help for homeless people and even for families of political prisoners. So they're an entire almost ecotopia of things.
Didn't you get the feeling that Chinese leaders, at least on some level, are encouraging a re-engagement with religious practices with the hope that a return to faith and values will kind of help organize Chinese life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the government is hoping that some kind of faith will help cure the national malaise in China, this feeling that there's a lack of values, that life is kind of unmoored from any kind of shared system of values to hold society together.
But more likely to support Buddhism, Taoism than Islam or Christian faiths?
Absolutely. Yeah, they feel a lot more comfortable with religions that they consider to be indigenous or quasi-indigenous, like Buddhism, which came to China 2,000 years ago, roughly, or Taoism. They feel more concerned with Christianity or Islam because of their foreign roots.
A survey found that in 2014, twice as many Buddhist and Taoist temples existed in China than just in 1990. Do you know if they were built or rebuilt with government or private money?
Sometimes with government money, sometimes as tourism projects and local areas, poor areas of the country, the government will sometimes build a temple and say, "Oh, we can charge money for it, and we can make money." But a lot of it are donors, people who are pious believers and simply donate money to these temples.
Now, Karl Marx famously called religion the opiate of the masses. Did you get a sense from people that you spoke to that they'd begun to feel more satisfied with their lives after they had joined churches or temples or adopted other spiritual practices like meditation?
Well, that term is great because I think in some ways the government still sees religion as an opiate of the masses. But if you want to look at it cynically, I think they hope that they can use this opiate to control the people. Whether people are happier or not, some I think are more satisfied.
Do they hope that if people become more religious, they'll see less corruption?
Less corruption, more decency in daily life. A lot of Chinese complain that their society is uncaring, that people don't look out for each other, that there's a harshness to daily life.
And do they think that's a recent development?
Well, people think it's gotten worse since China started economic reforms 30 or 40 years ago, that society's become simply based on how much money you earn and that kind of thing.
I'm speaking with Ian Johnson, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times. His latest book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. You've been based in China since the early 1980s. How long had Mao Zedong, who made communism China's official religion, been dead when you arrived?
Just 8 years. I got there in 84, and he died in 76.
Do you think there are still some people, because there are some we've heard, who are nostalgic for the good old days of Mao? Do you see some people who see communism still as a religion?
I think there are some people who really view the past with a nostalgia that borders on a religious belief, that they think those were the good old days. People were equal, there wasn't this corruption in society, and we were poor but on a more egalitarian.
People outside China assumed that many Chinese, especially members of ethnic minorities, had continued to practice their religions, but in secret while Mao was in power. Was that likely?
I think so. Yeah, I think that there was a lot of secret practice of religion. Christianity and other faiths survived underground. Now, obviously, a lot of people couldn't practice, but still, it wasn't as if it completely disappeared. The public practice disappeared, but in people's living rooms, in homes, maybe the statues were destroyed. They weren't allowed to light incense, let's say, but they could still perhaps recite a sutra quietly to themselves.
If they were caught, would they be sent to prison?
It could get that serious, yes. If you continued religious practice that was considered superstitious, even counter-revolutionary, and you could end up in a labor camp.
So when you arrived in China, what was the religious climate like? You arrived just after the Communist Party issued a statement called Document 19.
Document 19 called for the revival of religious life. This was seen as a sop maybe to some of the older people in society. They thought, well, we've caused so much trouble over the past decades.
Because of the Cultural Revolution.
The Cultural Revolution, and they said that excesses, leftist excesses, had dominated the first 30 years of power, and let's allow a little bit of religious life back. They didn't think it would explode. They thought this was just something for some old people who were going to die out over the next few years.
So they were wrong.
Absolutely.
But they made the practice only five religions legal and under strict state supervision. What religions were allowed?
So the religions that are allowed are Taoism, which is the indigenous religion in China, or Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, and then for administrative purposes, they split Christianity into two, Protestantism and Catholicism.
Now, Catholicism was a really important religion in the pre-communist era. Pearl Buck wrote about Christian missionaries. Are there still many Catholics in China?
Catholicism suffered because in 1949, all the foreigners who often ran the churches, who ran the hospitals, the schools, they were all expelled. The number of Catholics has increased, but it's basically just tracked population growth. It's probably because of this, it's probably the least dynamic of the five religions.
We had a guest on a show recently, a man named Alex Ryrie, who's written a book called Protestants, and he estimates that China currently has 100 million Christians. You think that number is right?
I think it's a little high. It's one of those suspiciously round numbers that people throw around. Any guesses? It is a guesstimate right now. We can't know. There are no surveys. I would say it's probably more like 60 million, but it's still a lot. It's still increased a lot, and it's still probably the fastest growing religion.
Although we're talking about 60 million in a country of over a billion people.
Yes, right. So it's proportionally it's small, but the rate of growth is interesting.
What about Protestants? What are the religions that are growing the fastest?
I think the fastest is probably Protestantism because it's less hierarchical, less organized. You can start a church without needing approval by something like the Vatican. And so the number of Protestants went up from 1 million in 1949 to over 50 million today, pretty fast. And then I think Buddhism, the great religion in East Asia, that's something a lot of Chinese feel a little bit more comfortable with. They feel that it's more part of their cultural life.
Even though it really comes from India.
It came from India, but, you know, a long time ago. So, yeah.
A monkey brought it in a famous novel.
Yes, Journey to the West.
Journey to the West.
Yeah, it's a great novel.
That was 16th century.
The novel was 16th century. It talks about some earlier quasi-historical event, but yeah. And Buddhism is growing quickly also.
You've compared China's current spiritual revival with the Great Awakening that occurred in the United States in the 19th century. Now, that was a Protestant event, but do you see a link between the two?
Well, the link is this. You have a country that's on the move with new economic structures coming up, a lot of people who are leaving the countryside, moving to cities, their lives are disoriented, they're searching for answers, and they're finding it in religion, spirituality, faith, that kind of thing.
Although only some. Falun Gong is suppressed.
Some religions are suppressed, especially Falun Gong.
What's the problem with Falun Gong for the Chinese government?
Chinese government was freaked out when in 1999 thousands of Falun Gong adherents did a sit-down strike right in front of the leadership compound. So they woke up one morning and seemingly out of the blue, there were thousands of people sitting cross-legged in front of the leadership compound, and they just banned it. And they said this. They overreacted. They thought this must be a terribly well-organized counter-revolutionary movement. It really wasn't, but it was something that just scared the heck out of them.
Now, is Falun Gong a Western-influenced religion?
Not at all. No, it's really a Chinese indigenous religion. It's in the tradition of a lot of these syncretic movements that came up over time in China, mixing a bit of Taoism and Buddhism and yoga-like physical practices.
And the government calls it a cult. But does the government also see it as a threat because there has been this history in China of religious groups that have wound up creating the equivalent of civil wars?
They probably banned it because they thought that it was something that was not under their control. I don't think it was any realistic chance of Falun Gong opposing or overthrowing the government.
But we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that control. My guest is Ian Johnson. His latest book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, it is published by Pantheon. We'll be back right after this. We're talking with Ian Johnson. His book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, is published by Pantheon. Let's talk about the kinds of controls or restrictions the Chinese government places on how its religious institutions can operate and how religion is practiced in China. Doesn't China's government prohibit the involvement of foreigners in Chinese temples, churches, and mosques? Made it illegal for Chinese religious institutions to affiliate with religious institutions in other countries? Would that make it really more difficult for Catholics because of the ties to the Vatican?
Yeah, foreign involvement is a red line, not just in religion, but in NGOs or any kind of organization. They don't want foreigners influencing China. They don't want foreign money coming into China. Foreign missionaries are completely taboo. And of course, as you said, the Vatican's, this is a major problem for Catholicism still today, 70 years later.
Mao expelled all foreign missionaries from China when he came to power in 1949. So that remains in effect despite the fact that Maoism is kind of dead?
It remains in effect, although in practice, people still come into China, especially Chinese-American Christians. They maybe come in on a tourist visa. Perhaps pastors or people, theologians, and they hold training sessions, but privately and quietly. But overwhelmingly, the religious growth in China is indigenous. It's self-generated. It's not, the foreign role is minimal. And I think this is something the government has overreacted to. There's very little foreign involvement overall.
Doesn't the Chinese government also reserve the right to choose the clergy and other leaders of its religious institutions?
Yeah, in the government-run organizations, they approve the bishops in the churches, even the ministers, the abbots, the abbesses at the main monasteries, etc.
The government collects information about who attends religious services and even sends representatives to the services to monitor what's being said from the pulpit.
They do, yes.
You spoke with, in fact, you devote a great deal of this book to a man named Wang Yi, the pastor I mentioned earlier. He's one of China's best-known preachers and the founder of the early Rain Reform Church in Chengdu. Does he have to report on the people who come to his services?
He does, even though he's not part of the government-run church, and he chooses to do this because he wants to be as open as possible so the government won't worry what's going on. So they actually video their own services, they video the sermons, and they make these videos available to authorities. If they want to see what happened last Sunday, they can go to their library and check it out.
Now, what kind of Protestant church is it? Is it similar to any we would recognize in the West?
They've identified themselves as Presbyterian or Calvinist, so they're very influenced by the Puritans, and they feel that...
The Puritans?
Yeah, they really believe that the Puritans brought over to the United States these ideas that helped found American democracy, the idea of God-given rights.
The work ethic.
They were very tough. In my book, I describe how they're insisting that everybody get a job and go out and work. So they see Calvinism or Puritanism as a kind of...
Well, you say that the early Rain Church is a house church. What's a house church?
Well, this is one of these terms. People say house churches or underground churches. They're not really adequate. These are terms. These are churches that are not registered by the government. They are. They used to be called underground or house churches because they were small. They were in people's houses or they were underground or in secret. But these churches now are big. This church that I describe had over 300 members. They owned half a floor of an office building, and they had regular services. And they weren't underground. The government knew they were there.
Well, they weren't underground because they're on the 19th floor of that office building.
Exactly. And the police officer came by every Monday and said, who attended church? And so they knew that they were there.
But they're technically operating illegally?
Absolutely. Illegally, yeah. But the government just turns a blind eye. As long as they're not agitating against the Communist Party, they're allowed to survive.
And as long as Wang Yi supplies the police with a list of names and addresses of everyone who attends services.
That's right, although...
Does that worry Wang Yi at all? Members of the congregation?
When they join the church, they have to provide their identity card, they make a photocopy of it, and they say, okay, you're a member. When you attend church, you've got to sign up on Sunday morning. And on Monday, if the government wants it, we're going to tell them who attended church because we don't want to be accused of being secretive or anti-government. But I have to say, Wang Yi himself, his sermons are very edgy, and he criticizes the government, he criticizes society. So he's not a lackey of the government. He's just trying to survive in this society.
And you point out that Early Rain Church has begun to organize help for the local homeless people and even to provide assistance to local families of people who are imprisoned for political crimes. That might be seen as a kind of slap in the face of the government.
Absolutely. No, the government doesn't like that at all. But so far, the government has not closed them down. So it's interesting. A lot of people expected that the church would be closed, but it's still open.
And why do you think it hasn't been closed down?
I think that the government doesn't want to alienate the members of the church. The members of these churches are often successful white-collar professionals, accountants, lawyers, doctors. And I think they feel, look, if we go after these people, there will be a backlash.
Helping homeless people and providing aid to families in need is the sort of thing that NGOs do in other parts of the world. Are they serving the function of NGOs, which the Chinese government doesn't allow In China?
In some ways they are. In some ways these are the only real NGOs in China, these unregistered churches. They are providing services, they're self-financing, they're self-organizing, they have their own elections, they appoint their own leaders. The government might monitor them by bugging their offices and so on, but they don't control them.
Do they see the government, this kind of social work, as a threat to governmental authority? Because in China, I'm assuming, the government thinks that it should be handling these things.
Yeah, the government does that, although they have encouraged a bit of philanthropy. They're okay if there's been a natural disaster, if you want to give some money, but they don't want you to try to change society.
You say that 175 million Chinese follow spiritual practices that are different from the five that are officially permitted. Would I recognize the names of any of those?
I would say these are more like folk religious practices.
That would go back into history?
Yeah, or physical, what we might call physical cultivation, something similar to yoga, breathing exercises, something like Tai Chi. But sometimes they'll have masters, they'll have books. They have a quasi-religious element to them.
My guest is Ian Johnson, whose latest book is The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. It's published by Pantheon. Mr. Johnson won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting for the Wall Street Journal on China's persecution of Falun Gong practitioners. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has the crackdown been effective?
On Falun Gong?
No.
Yes, I think.
Because we see an awful lot of Falun Gong demonstrations here in New York.
Yeah, overseas they're still quite active. They have a newspaper called Epoch Times. They have a television station. But they're overwhelmingly dead in China. They just really don't, you don't see any public presence at all.
And sometimes you're not even aware that the Falun Gong is behind something. I went to a concert of a Chinese cultural concert, and suddenly in the middle of it, after the dancing and the various musical events, there was a little playlet, and it was really about the Chinese government imprisoning members of the Falun Gong.
The Shengyun New Year's thing that they have. Yeah, it's very clever propaganda. They slip it in there after all the singing and dancing. Yeah.
You've written this book in the first person.
Well, I did it. It's, you know, the book is 90%. It's not a travelogue where I go around China telling about my experiences. I feel that first person in some ways is more honest because you can, as the reader, you know how I get information rather than an omniscient narrator that pretends that they're just a bug on the wall. You can see me interact with people and then you can judge for yourself if what I'm getting is accurate or not.
And you've organized the story you tell using the seasons of the Lunar New Year.
Yeah, this is a calendar that lost importance in the Mao era and in the communist era up until recently. And the Lunar New Year has really come back. Some of the holidays have now become national holidays. And these mini seasons that the year is divided into, 24 mini seasons of about 2 weeks or so each, they've come back. And I found it fascinating. Over the past 10 years, the clothes people wear, the food they eat, stores run sales based on these mini seasons. And I thought, this is a cool way of organizing it because time is how one of the most fundamental things in our society, how we organize time.
I saw a documentary a few years ago about the millions of people, many millions of people, who travel back to their home villages on the Lunar New Year. Is that a religious observance, or is that just another kind of tradition that never died?
It has a religious origin. It's something maybe like Thanksgiving in this country, where it, for many people it has a religious meaning, but for many others it's just a cultural event where you meet with family members and have a big meal together and that sort of thing. But originally, and for a lot of Chinese people, it does have religious meaning still, sure.
And how much does this resurgence of religion have to do with the fact that people are no longer living in their traditional villages in many cases, but have moved to these huge cities?
People feel very disoriented by that. They have lost the connection with their neighbors, and they're in these cities, they're looking for kind of an ersatz community. The churches are very good at providing that, for example. People go to these big, strange cities, and the church seems like a ready-made community of people who are probably honest. And
you speak Mandarin?
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, you couldn't have gotten to know some of the people you write about here as well as you do. You've called this book a six-year-long project. It took you 6 years to gather all this information?
Yeah.
Hasn't a lot changed over 6 years?
Well, things are changing, but the fundamental things have not changed. And I follow these people up through time, and I'm still in touch with them today. But it took a long time. You have to find the right examples in a book like this. You want people who are representative, people who aren't just outliers. And so there's a lot of false starts and dead ends that you encounter along the way.
You got to know a family of Taoist musicians and funeral directors from a rural Shaanxi province, also a Beijing family that supports religious pilgrims for 2 weeks each year by providing them with tea and steamed buns, and a group of Buddhist meditation masters. How willing were they to share their views with you? Did they fear that if they spoke too openly, they might get themselves in trouble?
I did not find that at all. I found people were just really excited that somebody from the outside cared to talk to them about it. And I think once you spend a bit of time, you show sincerity that you're really interested and you're taking careful notes and you're reading up on it, they're happy to tell you things. People brought me into the most intimate points of their lives. One guy in Beijing, for example, his mother just died, and he called me up on the phone and said, you know, we're going to have a big funeral. Why don't you come over and see how it happens? And many people, if they just lost a parent, they're not going to think of a foreign person very much, but they were extremely kind and hospitable.
Well, my experience when I lived in Chinatown was that the people there appreciated my interest because and considered me kind of like a strange foreigner.
Yeah, I mean, I think people in China often assume the outside world can never understand them and that there's a huge gap between the outside world and them. And so you're there trying to bridge it, and I found people were very helpful. They'd go over things many times, explain things over and over again until you get it right.
Would we recognize the Christianity that now exists in China?
I think so. I think the interesting thing is that people in China, Christians especially, are seeking what they consider to be authentic Christianity. So they're going on the internet, they're checking out how are churches organized there, what kind of books are they using, and they're downloading books that are published in Hong Kong or in the United States and other parts of the world to see what Christians there do.
What about the Uyghurs, Muslims, who seem to be at war with the Chinese government, and also to some degree the Tibetan Buddhists? Does the Chinese government distinguish between Tibetan Buddhism and other kinds of Buddhism?
Well, they do. Tibetan Buddhism is also popular in non-Tibetan parts of China among some ethnic Chinese, Han Chinese. The Uyghurs are a lot of difficulty because of terrorist movements that are active inside Xinjiang, and I think the government overall distrust of foreign influence on Islam. Not all Muslims, though, face that. Probably the majority of Muslims, certainly the majority of Muslims, are not Uyghurs, and they don't have as many problems. But there's prejudice. I think there's Islamophobia in China as well. There are regulations against men who wear beards getting on buses, women with the hijab on getting on buses, and they say, we don't want this. So there's a lot of tension there as well.
Part of the problem that China is just so huge that it really is a lot of different nations and somehow trying to function as one nation?
Well, the thing we can't forget about China is that the borders of China today are the old Qing Empire. And this was a multi-ethnic empire that was mostly forged in the 17th, 18th centuries by conquering a lot of people on the periphery of China who had been occasionally off and on again part of the Chinese empires, but never really part of a Chinese state. And now they are. So they have to figure out how do they deal with this multi-ethnic empire.
There's a major museum at a major exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art of Chinese art that goes all the way back 3,000 years when the first attempts were made by emperors to create some kind of sense of Chinese unity.
That's a great exhibition. I highly recommend it. It's got all kinds of treasures that you just don't see very much outside of China, so it's well worth seeing.
So what do you imagine the future holds for religion in China? Is it just going to kind of continue the way it is, or are we going to start seeing some really powerful religious institutions developing?
I think it is continuing. It will continue to grow. And what it does, I think, in the long run is it's not going to create a revolution against the state, at least not in the near future. I think instead it creates a sense of ideas like justice and righteousness that are heaven endowed. And this is something higher than any government program or platform. It gives people the idea, like the old Confucian idea, that they have a right to rebel. These kind of ideas will grow, I think, in China over the coming years.
Will Christianity be seen as a possible problem in the future if it becomes too popular?
I think it already is seen in some circles, in some parts of the government, as a problem, and they want to find ways to rein it in. So this is probably a source of tension going forward.
Ian Johnson is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times. His work has also appeared in The New Yorker, National Geographic. And his latest book is The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. It is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.